One of the strangest characters in the history of the Bible is Balaam, a prophet who was by King Balak of Moab to invoke a curse on the nation of Israel. But he found himself only able to pronounce a blessing. Interestingly, further, he was not a member of God's chosen people at all. He was a man of divination, and yet he had communication with the God of Israel. In the end, he led Israel into the grossest sin and met his death as a consequence. But he foretold Israel's glorious future and their ultimate triumph over all their enemies. The account is given in Numbers and covers chapters 22 to 24. So the time setting is the 14th century BC, almost 40 years after the nation of Israel had left Egypt, as you'll see on the map up there, under Moses. And Israel was now stationed at the border of Moab, which is on my right, pointing on the right-hand side there. And they're endeavouring to find a passage to the River Jordan in order to cross into their inheritance. Balak, who was the king of Moab, was becoming rather apprehensive that his own land was now being invaded. And with the superstitious times, he wanted the curse of the gods imposed upon the intruders in the belief that they would just disappear into thin air and cease to be a threat to him. So magic appeared the only answer. So King Balak needed the best magician money could buy. So he decided to send for Balaam, who lived at Petor on the Upper Euphrates. That is nearly 560 kilometres away. Balaam's fame had spread so far and wide in Numbers 22 and 6. "For I know that whom you bless is blessed, and whom you curse is cursed." The messengers of Balaam then undertook the long journey northward to entice the prophet Aram to return with them and to use his magic arts against the nation of Israel. In fact, historically, Babylonian tablets record of such misfortunes and divinations as well. So Balaam was not very accommodating in his initial behaviour and was perfectly correct. In Numbers 22 and 8, he says, "Spend the night here," to the messengers, "and I'll bring word back to you as the Lord may speak to me." The Hebrew word Lord here is interesting. It's Yahweh, Jehovah, in other words. So that night, Jehovah came to Balaam and he told him that a people had come out of Egypt and that King Balak of Moab wanted him to go and pronounce a curse over them to drive them away. Now, it's interesting to note that God told Balaam specifically, number one, he was not to go to Moab with this delegation, and number two, he was not to curse the people because they were blessed. So Balaam told Balak's leaders, "Go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you," in Numbers 22:13. However, when this was told to the king of Moab in verse 14, it became, "Balaam refused to come with us." The king thought he had not been explicit enough about his willingness to pay quite handsomely for the prophet's services. So a more distinguished delegation was sent to Balaam along with the promise, "I will indeed honour you richly and do whatever you say to me. Whatever you tell me, I will do. So please come then. Curse this people for me," in Numbers 22 and 17. You see, Satan knew the thinking of Balaam, and that Balaam secretly just loved a reward for his services. However, Balaam knew what the second delegation did not, that God had previously instructed him not to go, as Israel was a blessed people and he could not curse them. If only he had told the second delegation exactly that, they would have gone home immediately and the matter would have gone away. It is easy to establish the point where Balaam, you might say, took a wrong turn when he said, "Now please, you also stay here tonight and I'll find out what else the Lord will speak to me," in Numbers 22 and verse 19. You see, Balaam had no intention of deliberately disobeying God, but he began to harbour that secret hope that God might relent and allow him to go after all. God answers, as we know, a man according to the idol in his heart. And God spoke to Balaam again, "If the men come to call you, rise up and go with them. But only the word which I speak unto you shall you do." In verses 21 to 22, we are told, "So Balaam arose up in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the leaders of Moab. But God was angry because he was going." So a question pops up: why should God be angry in verse 22 with the man for doing what he had just been told to do? However, a careful reading of the text throws a light on this very point. God had come to Balaam at night in verse 20. God's instructions were quite explicit, but Balaam did not listen attentively. He chose to selectively hear what he wanted to hear and do. This verse clearly reads, "If the men came to call you." But they had not come. Yet Balaam rose up in the morning without having been called. You see, he was determined to go. So the journey began. He saddled his donkey and sent his two servants. And he began this journey to Moab. And the Lord, as we know in the account, sent an angel to awaken him to a realization of his big mistake. The angel blocked his way on three occasions. It was something the donkey saw, but Balaam, who was on top of riding her, did not. The first two times, the donkey attempted to go around the angel, but with rather unfortunate consequences for Balaam, as in the end, his foot was crushed against the wall, so he began to beat her. The third time, with no way around the angel, the donkey simply sat down. In his frustration, Balaam started to beat her again. And it was then that a most remarkable thing happened. The donkey spoke. 2 Peter 2:16 reads, "But he," that is referring to Balaam there, "was rebuked for his wrongdoing by a donkey, a beast without speech, who spoke with a man's voice and restrained the prophet's madness." If we go to the account in Numbers 22 and verses 28 to 30, we read, "And the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, 'What have I done to you, that you have struck me these three times?' Then Balaam said to the donkey, 'Because you have made a mockery of me. If there had been a sword in my hand, I would have killed you by now.' The donkey said to Balaam, 'Am I not your donkey, on which you have ridden all your life to this day? Have I ever been accustomed to so to you?' And he said, 'No.'" In Numbers 28 to 30, this account, it shows in the dialogue that anger can cause one to lose reason temporarily. And Balaam did not even question the very fact that his donkey was talking to him. The apparent permission to go, you see, was a test upon Balaam, which he miserably failed, leaving his home to do something specifically he had been told he was not to do cannot be justified on any level. By going to Moab, he exposed himself to greater temptation than if he had stayed home. He blinded himself to the risk he was taking, undoubtedly because the king was offering riches far beyond anything he had ever received before. His trusty donkey, who had served him so well for so many years, seemed committed in making him miserable, and he swore if he had a sword, he would kill her. It is then that his eyes were opened, and he saw an angel who had a sword and who was quite prepared to kill him for his actions. The angel and Balaam talked. Notice Balaam did not say, "I have sinned. I will return home immediately." Instead, watch his approach. "I have sinned. Now then," I'm sort of jumping a few words here, "if it is displeasing to you, I will turn back." He was almost trying to put the angel in the position of representing a double-minded Lord. One who had first told him to go and then told him to return home. But this experience continued to be a test of his fidelity. To do what was right, and he failed the test by continuing on when he was sure the angel would not stop him. When Balaam arrived in Moab and he met the king, he made it abundantly clear he could only speak the word that God puts in my mouth in verse 38. The king was not concerned, you see. He had experiences with his own prophets who were able to deliver the message they knew he wanted to hear. When Balaam used the word God, the king undoubtedly thought of a God quite different to the one true God, Jehovah. The king, he had no reason to believe he might have a problem expecting Balaam's curse to bring the wrath of the gods and scatter this nation of Israel away. The next day, the king and Balaam prepared for the cursing of Israel. And previously, God spoke to Balaam directly, without any special procedure. But you see, just to be on the safe side, Balaam asked that the king build 7 altars and sacrifice a bull and a ram on each one in Numbers 23 and 1. A question comes to mind, why 7 altars? Israel used one if he had done his history. Balaam maybe, I think, was an astrologer and understood all techniques and enchantments which he found in his predictions. You see, 7 altars for 7 gods effectively would be the 7 stars that they worshipped. Marduk, the sun god, Sin, the moon god, Nebo, Mercury, goddess Ishtar, Venus, warrior god was Nege, Mars to Nibu, and Jupiter and Adas and representing Saturn. In one of his many aspects, in offering sacrifices to all the heathen 7 gods, he was sure he could find an avenue to access the counsel of God. He acknowledged the crowd of lesser gods, but not the true God, who is the God of Israel. As we know in the Old Testament, Israel was strictly forbidden in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verses 19 to lift their eyes to worship stars. God had told Israel that sacrifices were to be made on one single altar, not on 7, but that aspect was ignored. At the end of the sacrificing, Balaam withdrew himself, looking for something to say that might satisfy the king without necessarily being a curse. But it was of no use. Balaam began by proudly declaring in verse 4, "I have set up 7 altars, I have offered up bull and a ram on each." But really, Balaam had not done such thing. It was the heathen king who did it. You see, Balaam was trying to emphasize that because of his efforts, God had just received a lot of animal sacrifices that he just loved so much. Perhaps now God would grant Balaam a small favor, quid pro quo, as it were in our language. What Balaam did not realize was that God has no pleasure in the blood of bulls and goats, as we know in Hebrews 10 and 6. So God sent Balaam back to the king with the first oracle. It was roughly a statement that he could not curse Israel, if you boil it down. The king became angry, claiming that Balaam had just blessed them in verse 11. Having no backup plan to deal with the military threat encamped at his borders, the king convinced himself that Balaam had been maybe awestruck because he had seen too many of the enemy below, about 8 kilometres away. And now, desperate to have Israel cursed, the king suggested they move to the field of Zophim. It's the top of Mount Pisgah, as it's called, from Israel's camp, which you'll see there on the map in the corner. And they could only see only part of the nation, you see there in verse 14. And there they repeated the altar building and the animal sacrificing, and again Balaam withdrew from the group. And this time God did all the talking. If you go into history further on in Numbers and Deuteronomy, later Moses saw the promised land actually from here. If you do your research, it gets rather interesting. But one cannot wonder at the patience and forbearance of God. This was the fifth time the matter had come to him, and each time the answer to Balaam had been positive. The prophet kept on coming back to ask, in effect, if the Lord really meant what he had said. Maybe God would reverse his decision and curse Israel. Still in the back of Balaam's mind was that huge carrot, that huge reward. But the Lord was not so accommodating, as we know. In verse 16, "Return to Balak, and thus you shall speak." And when he went back to the king, the situation really got worse. God was not going to change his mind. And in verse 18, he says, "Arise, O Balak, and hear. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and he will not do it? Or as he has spoken, will he not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. When he has blessed, then I cannot revoke it." So Balaam returned to the king, and it was really getting bad now. Among other things, Balaam said, "For as there is no omen or spell against Jacob, nor is there any divination against Israel, what God has done in verse 23. Near the end of his oracle, Balaam referred to the nation of Israel. This seemed really bad news indeed, since the only weapon the king thought he had was these magic spells and incantations. It had really all gone from bad to really worse. So Balak got desperate. "Do not curse them at all, or bless them at all," in verse 25. He wanted nothing now but to stop the mouth of this man who was destroying all his hopes. But again the prophet replied, "I told you all that the Lord speaketh, I must do." In Numbers 23:28, Balak thought superstitiously that the previous location was maybe not that favourable for a curse. As in that attempt, Balaam looked down, and Balaam was so impressed with Israel's order, organization, and control. He saw the tabernacle from above, 4 divisions of the tribe of Levi, 12 tribes placed in groupings of 3 each around the tabernacle. So Balak takes him to a third location. In Numbers 23:28, it's now the top of Mount Peor, as you'll notice there on the map. That was about in Imperials 15 miles away. It overlooked the wasteland, and again the altar built in went, the animal sacrifices repeated. This time Balaam did not withdraw himself and seek the Lord like the previous 2 occasions, if you note. He received another message from God. This time the Lord came to him in Numbers 24 verses 1 and 2. "The Spirit came upon him, and he uttered a magnificent blessing upon the nation of Israel," in verses 3 to 9. You see, when the Spirit of God is to come upon a man, it means that God is about to use him powerfully. And that, then the man needs to be in the right heart condition to be so used. Balaam was now God's man on the top of the hill of Moab. He was about to give the first of his prophecies concerning the end times. The events that are characterizing the end, actually, of the gospel age, and which are to be succeeded by the messianic reign. This was 5 centuries before the next great prophet, Joel, announced the prophecies. The Spirit gave him the words to speak, and once again Israel was blessed. How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, in verse 5. Blessed is everyone who blesses you, and curses is everyone who curses you, in verse 9. And then in verse 7, and his king, note these words, shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. You see, the ultimate future king of Israel will be higher than Agag. Agag, the king of Amalek, sometimes pictures Satan if you look through it in the scriptures. This prophet is saying that Jesus the Messiah will be higher than the god of this world, which is Satan. Jesus will overcome, defeat and destroy Satan, the antitypical Agag, and his followers. Agag is really, in a way, Gog, for the vowels are supplied. Thus, the king of the Amaleks is a prototype of Gog at the end of both the gospel and the kingdom age. The enemies of Israel who die in Jacob's trouble will be buried, we are told, in a cemetery called Harmon Gog. It's in Ezekiel 39:11-15. Haven't got time to prod that. Thus, Haman, in the book of Esther, who were by birth was an Agagite, is appropriately a picture of Gog. Balak now could take it no more, dismissing Balaam, telling him to return home with no fanfare, no reward. I thought to promote thee to great honour, but lo, the Lord hath kept thee back from honour. With that utterance, the king dismissed him. No sacrifices, nothing of any kind. In verse 10, Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have persisted in blessing them these 3 times. In verse 11, I said I would honour you greatly, but behold, the Lord has held you back from honour. Before returning, Balaam turned to the king and invited him to listen. And I will advise you what these people will do to your people in the days to come, in Numbers 24:15-24. His last oracle in Numbers 24:15-24 articulated God's plan to bless Israel. It included those ominous words in verse 17. I see him in a distant future, from Moffat's translation. A star shall come forth from Jacob. A scepter shall arise from Israel and shall crush through the forehead of Moab. That oracle is a wonderful affirmation of faith and loyalty. Balaam declared the full message. An interesting part of Balaam's fourth oracle is a quantum leap, I would call, into the future and the long-term operation of the plan of God regarding the nation of Israel. The key in his expression is in the days to come in verse 14. It refers to a time in the kingdom of this world have run their course and about to be superseded by the millennial reign of Christ. After the second advent, all relevant scriptures concur in viewing the ideal Israel restored to the Holy Land in a condition of faith in God and readiness for the future destiny as light bearers to the world. Any nation or people in the meantime which opposes Israel's onward progress to her destiny is thwarted in its aims and rendered impotent. Look at the track record. Egypt, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria. The list is growing and growing, and it will grow. Watch Israel if you want to know where we are in the stream of time with the prophecies. The oracle in Numbers 24:15-19 says, a star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel, and shall crush through the forehead of Moab. Edom shall be a possession. This prophecy to me appears to have not one, not two, but three fulfillments. Two literal, one symbolic. The first was the defeat of Moab and Edom during the reign of King David. The second, when Israel will defeat the descendants of Moab and Edom in a future battle with them. The third fulfillment, in which symbolic Edom is represented as Christendom, is finally overthrown. A star from Jacob and a scepter out of Israel, referring to those descending from the line of Jacob who would have the right to rule. This can be applied to both King David and Christ. The star out of Jacob could be connected very easily to Matthew 2 and verses 2 and 9, when it refers to the birth of Jesus and the wise men from the east being guided by the star in the east, which led them to the place where the child was located. As I mentioned, the first fulfillment of Balaam's fourth oracle took place during King David, when Israel defeated the Moabites and Edomites. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verses 2, 13, 14. There's a lot more on this as well. The second fulfillment is a reference to the future defeat and control of the peoples of Moab and Edom and Ammon by Israel with the guidance of Christ, and also it's cross-referenced in Isaiah 11, verses 11 to 14, when in that day the Lord shall lift up his hand a second time to recover, that's acquire and deliver, the remnant of his holy people Israel, which is left, and will lay lands in the hands upon Edom and Moab, and the Amorites will obey them. This area, if you want to transpose it on a map, is what we would say is Jordan. There's a lot more on this as well. Time doesn't permit. The third fulfillment may be referenced to Genesis 49:10, when it states, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh, Christ, comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." Psalm 110 and verse 2 refers to this right rule when it states, "The Lord will stretch forth your strong scepter from Zion," and saying, "Rule in the midst of your enemies." Edom symbolizes Christendom in the Christian world. They sell their birthright for special advantages for a pot of stew, like Esau, and misrepresent the true character of Christ for their own earthly gain. Symbolic Edom can be equated from symbolic Babylon in Revelations when we did our studies. Isaiah 63 verses 1 to 4 is very consistent with this interpretation. There is, Christ is described as he that comes from Edom in crimson garments, red from having trodden the winepress, as you recall, an event which is in Revelations chapter 14 verses 18 to 20, associates Christendom with the vine of the earth. Had this been the end of the story, one could have concluded that Balaam maintained his integrity to the very last and went home unblemished. But sadly, this is not the track record in the case. Keenly disappointed, having come so far, having done so much for nothing, Balaam must have pondered what could he do to curse Israel and get paid for his trouble. He could not go and do it directly. That had been made abundantly clear. By doing it indirectly, causing Israel to sin in such a way that God himself would curse them. It had happened before, and he heard about it. If you recall the sending of the fiery serpents earlier in the Numbers episode in 21:6. Balaam successfully advised the king to seduce Israel into the heathen practices, thereby angering Jehovah. The Israelites were led into idolatry, we are told, by Moabite women. Numbers 31:15-16 gives this, as does Numbers 25:1-2. This so angered the Lord that he sent a plague, and no fewer than we got a record, 24,000 died of Israel. In verse 9, it appears Balaam devised this strategy, and Revelations 2:14 also makes mention of Balaam. In Revelations 2:14, referring to the church in Pergamos, the church had there many heathen practices that they adopted. Ezekiel 44:6-14 touches on these as well. But when historically pagan Rome adopted Christianity as the official religion, they corrupted it with many pagan holidays, doctrines, practices. This was also the great introduction of the three fallacies, Trinity, hell, fire doctrines, as well as the idea of immortality of the soul, that prevailed in their predominant teachings from 539 to 1799 AD. So going back to our Balaam story, although the strategy appeared successful, it cost him his life. The battle the king of Moab anticipated occurred. There was an incredible slaughter. So they, in Numbers 31:7-8, they made war against Midian just as the Lord had commanded Moses. They killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian. They also killed Balaam, if you note, the son of Beor, with the sword. If Balaam had really gone home, he would have not been killed on that battlefield. Although at times Balaam did have the Spirit of God on him and in him, but at the very end he lost that spirit because he pursued money. Apostle Peter in 2 Peter 2:15 states, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. Jude 11 alludes, who seemed to imply that Balaam was chiefly interested in prophesying for money or gain, speaking of those who, for pay, have rushed headlong into the error of Balaam and perished in the rebellion of Korah. The tendency of many in Christendom throughout this age is to seek monetary gain and acclaim. Edom refusing Israel's passage through their land, making them go, if you saw the map, around it, could symbolise Christendom's refusal to allow other doctrinal viewpoints, causing the true church to hide during the height of papacy and to separate from Christendom from the late 1800s onward. Our glorified Redeemer in his last message to the church foretold that some of his followers would imitate Balaam for earthly advantage and put a stumbling block in the path of brethren, intimation is that harlotry and false worship would be on a higher plane at the end of the gospel age than that which stumbled the nation of Israel. In conclusion, Balaam knew what was right, yet he refused to do it. I would title that a self-inflicted blindness. Thus we see that God will not stop us from committing sin, although we will eventually reap the consequences of our actions. The lesson throughout Scripture is we cannot serve God and mammon. In Hebrews 6:24, the Greek word translated mammon is a better rendering in many versions as money. The world, the flesh, and the adversary all attempt to seduce us into unrighteousness. If our allegiance is not with God, we will die. Somehow those heathen women managed to convince the Jewish males that they could serve their God and still go on sinning, and it was all a big lie. One does not resist temptation by giving into it. One resists it by taking a firm stand on the side of righteousness. If only Balaam had said that his God had told him the Israelites were blessed and were going to stay that way, if he had never ventured forth from his home in the first place, he might have become one of the great prophets of that time, even though he was outside that inner circle of God's chosen people. Instead, he thought he could have it both ways. He thought he could have God's favour and the riches which an earthly king could give him. There really is no substitute for obeying God. Perfect heart obedience is the only way to please our dear Heavenly Father, and that will eventually result in our exaltation of faithful to the end. Those who follow their own counsel, even those superficially appearing to serve God, will be bitterly disappointed, as it is written in Matthew 7:21-23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did not we prophesy in your name, and in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. So may the Lord bless thee all in making your call election sure. Amen.